Before we begin, I want to ask you a question. What does it take to not only witness the transformation of an entire field of medicine, but to help shape it? In this episode of Moving the Needle in Medicine, I sit down with Dr. James Januzzi, one of the leading voices in cardiology and biomarkers, to discuss the moments, mentors, and decisions that helped define his remarkable career. From identifying the potential of biomarkers before they became standard practice, to helping guide the evolution of modern heart failure care, Dr. Januzzi offers a fascinating look at how innovation moves from idea to everyday medicine. We also explore lessons from sports cardiology and being a team doctor for the Boston Red Sox, the importance of mentorship, and what separates meaningful careers from impressive resumes. Whether you're interested in cardiology, research, leadership, or simply the journey behind a successful career in medicine, there's something here for you. Let's get started. So I have the pleasure to host Dr. Jim Januzzi here on the podcast, Moving the Needle in Medicine, produced by HCP Live. I'm super excited to be here. When we were thinking about this in the early stages, you were at the top of my list of folks that I wanted to show, you know, bring to the world, have them tell your story, have people hear your story. I've been, you know, had the pleasure of meeting you in similar fashion via Zoom. AHA 2021 or 2020, something in the COVID sphere.
I think it was probably 2020, you know, right when we were all hiding under our desks at home, afraid to go to big meetings.
Yep. And we had longed out to it, and you were doing a sports cardiology fireside chat through AHA.
Yeah, it was something like that. It was either that or about mentoring, you know. Right.
And it was just the kind of the awkwardness of Zoom where everybody's logging on and you're just like, I was at Penn State still, and I had the huge Bills plaque, which is actually right there in my office, not directly behind me. And you were like, so are you a Bills fan? And I'm like, yeah, I guess that's.
Yeah, how'd you guess? You know, you had like the big 20-foot banner on the wall. And I think I said something to you to the extent of, well, I'm sorry for you.
Well, because at the time, you know, they were kind of going through it, and they'd made the playoffs like once, and they were kind of going up and up. But, you know, then everybody kind of met in person finally. And, you know, I would say that the rest is history, but we're just getting started. So, again, super excited here. So, you know, just taking a step back, the whole goal of this podcast is really to talk to folks in the field of cardiology and medicine and hear their stories and how that fits in kind of the big picture of life and how that integrates, you know, and how medicine integrates into that. And, you know, I think what works very well is to let people tell their origin story. And so that's kind of how I kick things off here, and just, you know, tell me about like how you got to this point. And, you know, we'll key in on a couple key points that I'm super excited to hear about. But yeah, take it away.
Sure. Okay. Well, I mean, I think that one thing that we can say is that although medicine has its ups and downs, there are some things about it that make it very special. And one of the things about a career in medicine that maybe differentiates it from other careers is, you know, to some extent, it really benefits from the relationships we build over the years. And that's not just with our patients, but also with our colleagues, right? So, you know, my origin story, actually, mine is maybe a little more boring in the beginning, in the sense that I was always going to be a doctor. You know, it's not like I sort of was, you know, doing something else in life. I mean, sure, there were detours. I, you know, was an absolutely horrid student in college. I was more interested in playing guitar in a band and, you know, sort of not studying. But, you know, from the time I was a child, I always wanted to be a doctor. Part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, the inspiration for me to go into medicine is my dad, who retired for health reasons. But when he was at his peak, he was one of the busiest clinicians in lower Manhattan. had a very interesting practice with a unique mix of VIPs and other interesting individuals, but a large percentage of people from the neighborhood he grew up in Little Italy as well in New York City. So at any given time, his office was just full of really interesting people. He would take me on rounds when I was a child. And so I grew up very comfortable in the healthcare environment, in the hospital setting. I worked summer jobs in the hospital. I'm just a few years older than you, Alex. And so I'll give you some perspective. I was in high school working in the emergency department in Greenwich Village, New York, in St. Vincent's Hospital in the summer of 82, when all of the early AIDS cases were first starting to come in and no one knew what in the world we were dealing with at the time. Really striking experience to sort of be right in the midst of it all in one of the heaviest AIDS populations in the country. And so, you know, going through high school and college, I always knew I wanted to be a doctor, but there was this little issue with the fact that I sort of grossly underperformed academically in college, which, you know, I mean, you can say everything worked out and it did, but at the time, I came very close to torpedoing my chance at getting into medical school. And so what I did was I did something which is very common now, but at the time it really wasn't, which is I took 2 years off and I took a research position. And I worked at the Rockefeller University in New York City doing molecular biology. So when I was in college, I had done cell biology work. And so I took a job in a lab culturing. I was the cell culturist for the lab, but I also had some molecular biology projects. And now here's a little trivia for you. The ApoE knockout mouse that everybody uses, you know, as a model of atherosclerosis, I actually cultured the original stem cells for that that model. And so, you know, I was just pure dumb luck, you know, in a group of, you know, amazing scientists who published remarkable research. The ApoE knockout was one project. I led the work on the ApoA1, C3NA4 knockouts, which all, you know, have, I mean, I didn't lead, I led the work on cloning the genes, which they then took and knocked out. But the point is that, like, I was very much involved with cutting edge science, and I had no right to be. I mean, I was a complete disaster in college, but my PI recognized, and, you know, we can talk about mentorship later, but, you know, he recognized that I had the talent and the intellect to be able to manage it. I just didn't have the maturity, you know, during college. And so all the while working at Rockefeller, running gels and sequencing DNA and knocking genes out and blah, 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 all that stuff, I was still playing guitar in bands in New York City and, like, you know, but having fun and growing up. And I applied to medical school. And so I was a full professor of medicine at Harvard and an endowed professor at Harvard Medical School at age 43. I'll start by saying that. And, you know, I published 1,000 papers in my career at this point. I applied to 22 medical schools and got into one. I got into two. Ultimately, I was waitlisted at one, but I didn't get into the second one until after a month into the semester. And I was like, are you kidding me? I'm not going to switch. So, I mean, I barely got in, and from wire to wire in med school, I was first in my class. And, you know, I was ready for it. And not only that, I grew up in a medical environment. And so, you know, I had that advantage of being comfortable and knowing the jargon and understanding aspects of, you know, medical stuff. And that's really the launch pad. And, you know, I matched at Brigham and Women's. It was my top choice. I had a real chip on my shoulder. And that, to some extent, is why I approached med school the way I did, and then my subsequent career the way I did, because I knew that I could be a good doctor. I wanted to be a good doctor, but I almost couldn't because I was such an idiot. And so, you know, when I got into med school and then got into residency, I took things much more seriously and, you know, loved my time at the Brigham. But all the while I was planning on being a country doc, being a private practitioner like my dad. Being at the Brigham was really where things changed, and I sort of took a turn towards academics.
So I Googled or I PubMed'd your name. It says 996 publications.
Yep.
Literally 1,000. Like, that wasn't like an exaggeration.
No. I do not exaggerate.
Oh my gosh. So the story starts in New York City. I've always thought of you as a Boston guy, and obviously I've gotten to know you, but like, you're a New Yorker at heart.
Through and through. I mean, when I spend time in New York, it feels like home. I was born and raised in Manhattan, basically, and my parents moved. My parents were the first kids on their block to go to college, let alone, you know, sort of have, you know, professional jobs. And so they both were, you know, I give them such huge credit. I give my grandparents, who are immigrants, huge credit for, you know, really instilling the importance of hard work in my parents and in, you know, their grandkids. I lived in Manhattan until I was 6, and then my parents moved to New Jersey. They moved on up, you know? And so, you know, these kids from Little Italy, they were moving to New Jersey. So I spent my adolescent years in New Jersey. All of my summer jobs were in New York at St. Vincent's, where my dad was. All the weekend nights we would go out in Manhattan. We wouldn't go we wouldn't go to the cornfields drinking beer. We'd actually go into New York, you know, and because we live not far. We're in a suburb right close to Manhattan. So, you know, when people ask, and the town I grew up in, by the way, in Jersey, was right on the New York state border. So, you know, when people ask me where I'm from, I say, I'm a New Yorker, you know, because to a large extent, that's where my world was.
So then how was the transition to Boston? Because, you know, not to bring in sports rivalries right off the bat, but I know that that's a big part of our relationship. And sure. I believe that there is a little bit of a rivalry between New York and Boston sports teams. So how did that play?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I'll talk about the sports thing very quickly, and then I'll talk about the transition up here. I mean, you know, everyone growing up in the tri-state area in the 70s, I was born in 66, right? So when the Yankees were on top of the world in the 70s, I was like 10 years old, right? So how could you not, right, you know, be enthralled by, you know, Reggie Jackson and, you know, that all of that, you know, the summer of 78. But it turns out my grandfather, God love him, immigrant from Italy, loved the Mets for some reason. And so growing up, we had sort of a home sort of brewed affinity for the Mets. And my parents got season tickets for the Mets in 1986, which was the year they won the World Series, beating the Red Sox, actually. So it's always been kind of
Bill Buckner, like
that. Correct. When Bill Buckner had the ball go through his legs. And I, you know, we can talk about this sometime. I mean, I've been a team physician for the Red Sox for 21 years now and have had the opportunity to meet some of the players from the 86 team. I took care of some of them, including their manager and some of the players. But, you know, it's just kind of amazing and ironic, you know, to find myself, you know, up here all these years later. But, you know, what's really interesting, Alex, I spent 4 years in Worcester at Holy Cross. I've spent now 32 years, you know, in Boston since I came up for internship. So I'm 59 years old. More than half of my life has been spent in Massachusetts. And so I really, at this point, do consider it home. My children were born here. They consider it home. And I love it up here. I really do. And I don't envision that I would move.
I mean, I love like watching you go to sports games, and your daughter works for some of the teams now. And then I love when I see the pictures of you guys, like at the Celtics games or and at the Red Sox games and everything like that. It just brings me so much joy. Obviously, sports are a huge part of my life and my family and extended, you know, sports fandom family and everything like that. So
absolutely. It has really added such an important aspect to our lives up here.
How do you, this is kind of going off script of what we, you know, wanted to talk about, but ad-libbing, how would you compare sports and medicines, comparing and contrasting, you know, sports teams and medicine as a team sport and everything like that?
Oh, I mean, there are so many parallels, Alex. You know, it is a team sport, medicine. You know, you can have the best and brightest in a residency fellowship or staff group, but if they are not a team, if there is no chemistry, it can be a real problem. And we've seen this again and again, whether it's in residency groups, in fellowship groups, or in, you know, attendings that, you know, that are hired, where the chemistry just isn't good and it doesn't work out. And I give a lot of credit. I learned a lot about leadership selection, identifying future leaders from my residency director in medicine, from Marshall Wolf, who would bring key members of the residency group into the decision-making about who they would take on as residents. And at the time, the Brigham, and still is, was very competitive to match at. And it wasn't just who was the smartest. It wasn't just who had the best grades. There was a great amount of emphasis put on how well do they work with each other? You know, have they rotated here? And what do you know about them? You could be the smartest, you could be a particle physicist, but if you couldn't work together well, he didn't want you in the team. And I think that that's a really important take home for medicine, because in case people haven't noticed, being a doctor, being a nurse practitioner, it's not an easy life. And, you know, having colleagues who support you above and beyond the 9-to-5 grind, I think is really important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you bring up some great points, and just early themes here is like the progression of things isn't always, you know, you weren't like blowing, you know, things out of the water in college and getting, you know, straight A's and a shoe in for everything and had your pick of the litter. And sometimes I think, you know, when we talk about MCAT scores and 4.0 GPA,
I did terribly
and all
terribly.
These things. But I think that, you know, what you did cultivate was that sense of community, you know, around you, both culturally, you know, with sports, with family. And I think that then that ties into, you know, working as a team sport, as a resident, as a fellow, as an early attending. And I think that, you know, that's a key thing. And frankly, I don't think it's talked about enough when we interview for residency.
Oh, 100%.
You know, because people are weeded out because of MCAT scores or grades or what college or med school they went to. Unfortunately, you know, you have to do something. But
I mean, the problem is, I mean, you know, you look at to connect it back to sports. I mean, you know, you hear about people being, you know, toxic in the clubhouse, you know, problems in the clubhouse leading to dysfunction with the team. It's the same in medicine. I mean, let's be honest, you know, and so that is, I think, such an important aspect of medicine, is supporting each other and focusing on teamwork. And to bring it back to sports, sometimes a team that is not full of people who are, you know, 40 home run, 50 home run hitters can be better than teams that have that kind of, talent, right?
Yeah. More cohesive team, almost the whole Moneyball approach.
Right.
So, all right. So walk me through. So then what happened? So you trained in Boston and then early faculty. Walk me through that and then tell me about how that eventually transitioned into your CCU director role and other early leadership roles that you had.
Right. So, you know, I got up to Boston and I, like many people, and I'm not afraid to talk about this. I mean, you know, I'm sure Andrew Sauer, who was on your program, also talked about it. I mean, I suffer from serious self-doubt at times. You know, I suffer from imposter syndrome. Even now, I still do. I got up to Boston and was immediately completely intimidated. I thought, I don't belong here. These are all the smartest people in the world. You know, how in the world, you know, did I get here? And, you know, I give a lot of credit to my dad who, you know, when I got to the Brigham and I was really feeling uneasy about everything, you know, he pulled me aside at a residency function where he could tell I was like off the walls anxious. And he walked up to me and he just looked at me and he said two words. And this has stuck with me. And I've told others, colleagues of ours as well. He looked at me and he just said, "Hey, you belong. Just remember that," you know? And, you know, that has, you know, that concept of when you see people struggling, you know, to sort of perform at our level sometimes, you know, you have to remember that there's a person there, right? And he really helped me sort of get over that early hump. And I, you know, I killed it in residency. I loved doing what I was doing. I was working with some of the smartest clinical trialists, people at the cutting edge of new medicines and diagnostics and therapeutics. And I just got completely enthralled with academics. And I was a basic scientist, as I said, but didn't want to be a basic scientist anymore. This concept of biomarkers was starting. I was a junior resident when troponin started to get measured. And it became really interesting to me that you could measure something in the blood that actually tells you about something in the heart, which tells you about what you should do clinically, right? And there was no such thing as translational medicine at the time. It just didn't exist. But that concept was what I really got interested in. And so there was someone else in my residency group who some people may recognize, wildly successful, wonderful guy named Dave Morrow. Dave was working with the Timmy group and he was going to be their troponin guy. So there was only room for one. And so I said, all right, I'm going to go cross town to Mass General. Nobody there was working on biomarkers. In fact, they didn't even measure troponin when I got there as a fellow. And so I took on the role as the biomarker guy and developed this sort of clinical and research existence that led to a focus on acute coronary syndromes, acute myocardial infarction early on in my career. And that's how I got hooked up with the cardiac intensive care unit. I was initially the assistant director, and then I took on the directorship after a couple of years.
That's fascinating. So how early in your career, like how many years out of training did you take on that role?
2 years.
2 years.
So I became the assistant director 2 years out. And I tell mentees and colleagues, friends, you know, you should live your career in 5 year blocks. You know, I try to pivot or have a plan. And you know, although it accelerated pretty quickly after I came on staff, I mean, part of the issue is like, at the time, I didn't realize that like taking on a non-salaried assistant directorship role wasn't a good deal. It seemed great to me at the time. You know, for your viewers, don't work for free.
That's been a constant theme here.
Huge.
We're gonna hammer that one home.
Oh, huge in medicine. I get so fired up on this topic. You know, do not debase yourself. You are worth way more than that. But I did it, right? And, you know, my thought process was it's going to lead to something. And it eventually did. In 2002, I was still very heavy into sort of troponin research, acute myocardial infarction. Some of my earliest research was on antithrombotics like 2B3A blockers and troponins and things like that. I caught the attention of a sponsor that was developing a new blood test for heart failure called N-terminal pro-BNP. You've heard of it now. At the time, nobody had heard of it. BNP, there was another one. The other test was BNP, and that one actually people had heard of. But NT-proBNP, nobody knew a thing about it. Nobody had done any studies with it in the United States. There were some things in Europe, but, you know, the company is European. But they came to me and they said, we've got this blood test and we're interested in seeing if you want to do the first US-based studies with it. Here's another lesson for your viewers. So I remember it as clear as day. I remember the name of the person who came to me. I remember when it was. It was in July of 2002. She comes to me and she says to me, we're interested in getting a proposal from you. And I thought about it and I said, no, I'm not interested. I said, you know, I'm a troponin guy. I'm an MI person. I don't want to do heart failure. And so I went happily on my way. She came back again and said, no, we're really serious. Humor us. And I said, okay, fine. That decision is probably the single most important decision in my entire career, because it really led to an academic profile, an academic career. You know, it defined my life. You know, I essentially have become a heart failure doctor to a large extent, a trialist because of it. And that research, the first studies that we did in 2003-04 at Mass General Hospital are still the foundation for all of the NT-proBNP cutoffs that are used internationally. And now, you know, every large vendor is developing an NT-proBNP assay, and I'm the principal investigator on, you know, the Abbott assay, the Siemens assay, the, you know, it's really kind of cool to see this all sort of 20 plus years later now being a standard of care.
And so, like, backing up, you know, say that you were the perfect student and you didn't take those couple of years off and work in the lab, you know, like, some of that maybe doesn't happen. You don't get the cell biology background, you know, and you're using another term that we would probably use is like be a nerd. You know, I spent tons of years in the lab, so I feel like I can.
Alex, I'm a biomarker guy. I'm like king nerd, right? You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, but it's fascinating. And obviously, you know, some of these things, you never know how they're going to work out. You know, we say, you know, no to things and yes to things, and you don't know. It sounds like in this case, they really saw something in you, and it was a fruitful relationship. Obviously, you'd done biomarkers with troponins and whatnot, and, you know, you just kind of ran with it. And, you know,
I didn't have a mentor. And, you know, I think part of the issue here was if I had someone I could talk to and ask, is this a good opportunity? Should I do it? I might not have almost torpedoed my entire future, you know. You know, having humility is really important in medicine, generally speaking, you know. And you know, I think at the time I just didn't know where to turn and ask for advice. And I was just really fortunate that I changed my mind.
And so how was it kind of like working in this space before it was mainstream? You know, now we think about like biomarkers and it's like, oh, you know, like let's check biomarkers, right? Let's trend them. Let's do this. Let's do that.
It was terrible. It was,
you know, no inertia for it, right?
There was not only inertia, but there was opposition, right? You know? And I find it interesting that I see people who were some of the loudest opponents literally coming to the microphone at meetings, like at HFSA, and saying insulting things to me. I mean, no joke, who are now leading clinical trials whose entire basis is biomarker testing. You know, it just, like I said, humility is so important in medicine. And, you know, there was a whole generation of clinicians and trialists and researchers who were completely over their skis. They didn't know how to understand the data. They didn't want to believe the data. So rather than trying to overcome that, there was more opposition than acceptance at the time, right? You're just a biomarker guy, you know? Well, this biomarker guy's principal investigator on 9 studies right now. So it turns out that biomarker guys can do research too. And, you know, I find it interesting to see the evolution accelerating in medicine now, in part thanks to younger generations who have come up understanding and learning it in a different way. So the acceptance has accelerated.
I mean, it's really fascinating. I think, you know, as I was prepping for this, I reached out to some folks, and I asked them, and I said that we're going to have you on the podcast. And is there anything else to ask? And one of the things that Andrew Sauer actually mentioned was saying, you know, how you were on service in the CCU in July when all the new fresh trainees were coming in. And, you know, anybody who's in medicine is always, you know, you remember your first, like,
sure.
You remember your first week of July, you remember your first night shift. For some people that starts all together, you know, first yep. night, overnight in the CCU, you know, you now you're the resident or you're the fellow, you're the first call.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you have a ton of stories.
Oh my God. I did it for 10 years. I did 10 years of the first week of July, you know, and so every 4th of July I was in the intensive care unit. You know, and yes, those were good days. I couldn't do it now, honestly, you know, to be clear, Alex, you know, it's both physically challenging and emotionally challenging. And at a time in my life where the biggest commodity that I have in my life now is time, you know, it was obvious that as the intensive care unit model needed to evolve, so did I, right? And so I did the unit for, you know, a good 10 years. I was on top of the world clinically and, you know, was, you know, a heavy volume clinician and loved the job. But, you know, it was clear the demographics of patients in the unit were changing. The comorbidity burden, the severity of disease was worsening. So some of the changes that I put in the unit were compared to when Sauer went through, when it was literally, you know, the Hunger Games, there'd be like one person on call overnight for 16 patients. I increased the residency coverage in the unit. I added intensivists to the unit. Then I closed the model so that only the cardiology attendings, two of them, could be the attendings of record. So if one of my patients was in the unit and I was not on service, I was not the attending. And then eventually stepped away to let the intensivists take over as the directors. All of this was self-inflicted wounds. I mean, I knew that, you know, it was the right thing to do for patients, for the hospital. And it was also the right time for me because at that time in my career, when I stepped away, was right when I got the job opportunity at Harvard Clinical Research Institute, which became the BAME Institute. And that's when my clinical trial, you know, career really took off.
So we'll get to more BAME in a little bit, but I still want to talk on the clinical side and trainee relationships. Tell me about this whole morning report thing at MGH. That I've heard so much about, but I've actually never really asked you about it. I've just kind of heard it from Sauer and others.
Yeah. So I'm going to turn off my blur for a second because I have a photograph sitting on my desk here from Morning Report. It's blurred. Hold on. So let's see if I can get it to come into focus. There we go. A little better.
There we go.
So Bill Deck, my former chief, me, Dolph Hutter, and I'm the Adolf Hutter Professor of Medicine now, Roman DeSantis and Eric Isselbacher. So Bill was the chief, but the four of us did Morning Report with the fellows as a foursome. We were actually nicknamed the Four Horsemen, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And we did it literally twice a week, Monday mornings, Friday mornings, 8 to 9 a.m. for 20 plus years.
Wow.
It really ended. The four of us sort of dissolved at the time of the pandemic, partially because Roman was, you know, close, was 90 years old, was retiring. Dolph retired. There's a whole generation of cardiologists that we trained at Mass General, where we did Morning Report, and it was literally twice a week where a fellow would present a case, and it wasn't stump the chump. It wasn't like they were presenting to us and we had to figure it out. What they did was they would present the case, and part of it was how to present a case. And, you know, strikingly, that's not a talent that a lot of people learn, you know? But also how, for the rest of the room, how to think about the case as it's evolving in front of your eyes. And, you know, the New England Journal of Medicine did that, the clinical clinical problem solving series. They may have stopped it years ago, but they used to do that where the discussant wouldn't say within 2 minutes, I think it's this. They would say, okay, you've got somebody with these symptoms. What are you going to think about? What tests are you going to do? When do you go to the cath lab? When do you not? It was also at times not the kindest and gentlest process. You know, Dr. Hutter, one of my mentors, brilliant clinician, former ACC president, really expected a lot of the fellows and would, you know, at times say, I'm not telling you the answer. You need to tell me what the answer is. You know, he would put people on the spot. And, you know, what was interesting is that although times have changed in medicine and that style is no longer really supported, you know, I will say it trained people well. And if you ask generations of cardiologists that trained at Mass General, sure, there'll be people who say, it was too rough at times, but a great majority will say it was the best part of their training because it taught them how to be decisive, how to be a cardiologist, and to learn from people like Hutter, like DeSantis, like Eric Isselbacher, who's brilliant with aortic disease. And I was sort of like the jack of all trades, you know, like I had this stupid ability to remember, you know, internal medicine stuff, cardiology stuff. I was an imager. I was a biomarker guy. So if an esoterica case came along, I'd jump on it and sort of work through, you know, the differential and how to work it up. It was just great. It was, you know, and that's why I have, you know, photos of, you know, Dolph and Roman and, you know, these guys all over my office, because it made me a better cardiologist while training a whole generation of wonderful trainees.
That's amazing. And then, you know, you kind of mentioned evolution of styles and everything. Do you think that your teaching style and, you know, clinical style has evolved also over the years?
A little bit. Yeah. So, yes, I have become much more kinder and gentler, I think, in my style. Not that I was ever mean, but I was, you know, on rounds in the unit, for example, you know, you talk to Sauer about this, you know, Andrew would say that if he saw that I was returning to the unit in the afternoon to deal with an issue, he said that he would leave, he would scat. So it wasn't that I was mean, but I think that, you know, to some extent, and forgive me for saying, you know, I think there are at times we have lost the importance of that real commitment in medicine to the patient. And, you know, you got to bleed for your patients sometimes. So it was, you know, at that time, you know, I would expect a lot from the people that I worked with. But I would never, ever in a million years not be right at the bedside with them. You know, like I've been watching for about the 10th time now, I've been watching Band of Brothers, you know, on cable. And, you know, one of the key messages from that was that the commander of the squad, the platoon, Easy Company, was always right there with them, right at the front lines. He would run first into battle, you know? And to me, that model was very much how I practiced. And to some extent, it's the same in research now, you know? I roll up my sleeves and I stay very engaged with all of my team, you know, my teams in the different trials that I'm running. I'm very involved. You know, I support my team, but I also lead them. And I think that that's an important aspect, I think, to succeed, because, you know, patients depend on us. Our teams depend on us. And it's a great way to mentor people. You know, it's a great way to get to know people side by side and lift them up.
So when you were going through this whole inertia of getting biomarkers involved in heart failure care and everything like that, how, you know, from your perspective, have you seen the world of heart failure evolve? I mean, you know, you're not advanced heart failure trained per se, but I've always, you know, thought of you as heart failure, but, you know, general heart failure. And I'm not saying that there's any negative connotation.
Well, no, of course not. I'm a general. No, dude, people don't know. I'm a general cardiologist. I mean, like I see just as many people without heart failure as I see people with. It just so happens I can really do heart failure well, you know, and you know, the evolution of heart failure from being a completely clinical diagnosis to now being a diagnosis that can be recognized even before signs and symptoms develop using diagnostics like imaging, like biomarkers, has completely changed the philosophy of what heart failure is. And so, you know, for me, I've been saying this for 20 years. I'm glad that people are getting it now. And, you know, I did the first diagnosis studies with NT-proBNP. I did some of the first prognosis studies. I certainly have done probably far too many, you know, prognosis studies of varying types in different disease states with NT-proBNP. And I've, you know, done some of the management studies with it. You know, it's really been interesting to see that evolution of a test that was initially developed just to diagnose heart failure in somebody with shortness of breath over in the emergency room to now being a tool that's used at all phases of the disease.
And then how do you, you know, kind of flipping a little bit on the GDMT realm and the heart failure treatment realm, you know, how have you seen the progression of that? You know, if someone's coming into the field now, it's like, okay, four pillars, I do this. It's so easy, right?
Oh yeah, so easy.
But that was all stepwise process. And there's all these studies over 30, 40, you know, plus years, right?
So when I was a resident, I did not like heart. I mean, part of the reason why I said no about NT-proBNP initially was I still had some aspects of dislike of heart failure because I actually used the term cardio-oncology to refer to heart failure when I was a resident. Believe it or not, that term's not so new because people with heart failure back in the sort of the late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s, you know, they got digoxin, a diuretic, and an ACE inhibitor. You know, we only started giving beta blockers when I was a resident, and the prognosis was awful. Most of the patients had low EF. HFpEF really didn't exist. The prognosis was terrible, and it was through, you know, the development of, you know, novel diagnostics and therapeutics that the prognosis of heart failure rapidly improved. And you can really make such a huge difference for patients compared to the way it was back then. And so now, sure, you know, you can take an ejection fraction of 20% and make it normal again, at least for a period of time. But even still, there are opportunities to improve adherence to therapy, prescription of therapy, persistence of therapy. And by the way, even on four drugs, there's still space under the Kaplan-Meier curve. So there's opportunities to improve things even further. So, I think we're off the starting line with heart failure, but we have a long, long way to go. It's not the same diagnosis it was 30 years ago. It's definitely improved, but it still comes with a prognosis as bad as, you know, esophageal cancer. So we can do better.
Is there one study or paper that sticks out above all else that, you know, you think about or that was like impactful in your career? You know, for me, I think of like Guide and Champion and, you know, being in remote monitoring and hemodynamics. Obviously, there's a ton of other ones. That one sure is in my niche. But, you know, does anything be like, you're like, oh, like solved in 1987 was this whole
thing? Yeah. Well, since we're talking about GDMT, sure. So I was at the late breaking clinical trial presentation when I was probably a first or second year fellow of the MERIT heart failure study, which was the study that launched metoprolol succinate for heart failure. I was in the audience. I remember like, wow, you know, like, we weren't supposed to give beta blockers, and yet here we are. Now, carvedilol had already made it on the scene, so it wasn't such a shock.
Right.
But still, you know, that really, I remember that moment quite vividly. Paradigm, you know, Paradigm changed everything for me, because it was a study that showed that A, you could kill the king, you can knock ACE inhibitors out of the pole position. Number two, or I said A, so B, there was a huge tie-in with NT-proBNP and biomarkers, right? Sacubitril valsartan, as I've said in my lectures, it's like napalm for NT-proBNP. If you've got someone with heart failure whose NT-pro isn't coming down, start them on Entresto. I guarantee you, you'll see a 37% reduction. I don't care where you start. 500, 37%. 1,000, 37%. 10,000, 37%. So that to me was also a real big moment. And then, I mean, you can see how I got into the whole GDMT thing. So that was really cool. But another example of something I said no to initially. I was walking across the street outside here, and I got a phone call from a clinical research organization looking for people to participate in the safety monitoring, the endpoint committee for diabetes trials. This was, I don't know, mid-2000s. And I was like, what's the work load going to be like? I was like, diabetes, yuck, you know, why would I do that? And I was like, I need to think about it. I was a young attending, could use the extra money. So I said, fine, I'll do it. You know, it was the EMPA-REG outcome study. And, you know, empagliflozin, there it was. I was on the endpoint committee for EMPA-REG. So when they broke the blind, we were like, you know, and that immediately got me involved with SGLT2 inhibitors and heart failure. So, you know, if I had said no, who knows, you know, if I would have had that opportunity to be involved with the Emperor trials, the Chief HF trial, you know, it's hard to know.
Right. So I want to bring up a couple tweets that have been pivotal in our relationship over the last couple of years, because when you're talking about GDMT, I remember one specifically, and I didn't prep for this. I was actually able to search it on my phone. Because I know I screenshotted it because it like stood out to me. It's actually a response to a tweet from Andrew Sauer, shocker. And it's about GDMT, and I'm just going to read it. I don't know what led up to it, but it's obviously, you know, Sauer talking about GDMT and probably pinged you and brought you in. And then you go, I love each one of them as if they were my kids. There's the solid one that takes work, beta blocker. The one that's the superstar student, but may make you dizzy, Arnie. The one you're grateful for, but you need to watch, MRA. And the surprise child no one expected, SGLT2. This was November 14th, 2020 at 5:39 p.m. And I just remember being like, it's like so awesome. And you know, like we were talking about it. And I think that tweet led to the next kind of drumming up of tweets with then you and I talking about how, oh, we need to assign NFL quarterbacks to all the right. GDMT. Because, you know, naturally we can't save sports out of anything. And
at the time, Tom Brady was still with the Patriots, right?
So I think it was. Oh man, I should know this, but it definitely was Brady and Rodgers. I think were beta blocker and Arnie, and I can't remember what we said was which. I mean, if you're talking the GOAT, you know, long term, I guess beta blockers, but hypothetically, Arnie.
I think I probably made him Arnie because, yeah. you know, that was
just the biomarkers and the Boston, you know, yeah, right. It's fair. And then it was the surprise child that no one knew was Josh Allen. And this was like, you know, before the true rise. I mean, obviously, blind Buffalo hope, like we always like wanted him to be the savior and, you know, MVPs and, you know, dynasty like later, despite not winning anything, hopefully one day. But and then it was Mahomes as MRA.
Right. Well, we had to give that to Andrew.
Right. Well, because it had the Stalwart thing in Kansas City and MRAs and all, and it was So, you know, I remember that, and I've used like the screenshot of that tweet in like so many talks, and we, you know, we've joked around how we have to like edit it now that Brady and, you know, like Roger, you know, whatever, if he's, is he retired, is he not retired, all these things. But it was that tweet, and then the other one, which someone tweeted a picture of like it was like CHF like lawn services or something like that. And I doctored up some, you know, Photoshop thing where I added all the EDMT to it, but I added like ace/arb/Arnie, and you're like, actually, and you know,
actually, I think I subtweeted you. I subtweeted you, yeah.
You know, and you're like, actually, get ace and arb out of there unless you want to, you know, prevent like life saving therapies from patients. And then, you know, we kind of joked around about it and everything like that, but you know.
Yeah, the funny thing is, I mean, like my Twitter profile is gone at this point, but you know, at the time I was sort of waxing philosophic about, you know, I think I used a patient example of somebody I turned around their EF, you know, and I said, you know, this is a great example of how, and I hashtagged GDMT and I wrote works after it, but I think at the time I accidentally didn't put a space between GDMT and works. I think I was trying to fit a long, you know, thing.
Right. Yeah, you're in the character count.
And I created a hashtag that for a while was used all the time, you know, it was everywhere. And you know, I was at an ACC meeting at a big, like in a lecture in the big room, and the speaker had it on their slide. And I thought to myself, you know, here I am slaving away, writing manuscripts, trying to change medicine. And my biggest legacy is going to be a hashtag from Twitter.
Accidentally because he needed to fill it in the character. Like
I remember, I remember writing it. I was lying in bed before, like, you know, lying in bed before going to sleep. And I was doing like everyone finishing the day on social media. And I remember writing it and like putting it down. Like the next day it was like retweeted all. I mean, it was crazy, you know?
Well, you know, I think it brings up the whole social media aspect, and it's waxed and wanes and all these things, and there's different platforms. I think at the end of the day, it brought together people, you know, like-minded people that were able to communicate over, you know, any platform. And, you know, Clubhouse was a thing for a while, and Twitter and X, you know, whatever. Now it's Facebook, you know, previously Facebook, and now Instagram, you know, has their little space. But I think that the heart failure community especially like used it incredibly well for networking. For it was, you know, like a new trial would come out during COVID and everybody would, you know, you weren't reading an editorial, you were reading to like someone's tweetorial about it. And it was the fastest dissemination of information, and it was a new age, and everybody was just on their phones because like what else did you have to do? You're in the pandemic,
right?
And it built up all this inertia. For then when we all met up in person, it was like, hey, yeah, we've been like pen pals basically for 2 to 3 years, like locked up in rooms. So good to meet you. And I remember the first time I met you, you know, because we talked like this for a while and like this. And I'm like, oh, this
guy's exactly tall. You're a lot taller than I thought. Yeah, exactly. I mean,
I knew you were tall, but like, so are you 6'5", right?
Yeah. Yeah, when I was in high school, I played basketball. I was a solid 6'6", but I've herniated 2 discs now. I've lost height, you know, and so I'm in between 6'4" and 6'5".
So, you know, I think that it's been fascinating, you know, just getting to know you in the heart failure space. Frankly, like almost like not. I mean, I met you as a resident. I didn't even know all the ins and outs of heart failure and all these things. I was still learning. But I think you've mentioned a couple of different things. One is mentorship, but you keyed on a couple other non-clinical, experiences that you've had, and you mentioned BAME Institute. So tell me a little bit about, you know, navigating the non-clinical opportunities, and maybe give yourself an example of what you've done with BAME and also like industry relationship. And I know that's big question, but
it's a big question. I mean, I can simplify it to basically say that the line between, you know, industry and NIH research really is getting more and more blurred, in part because NIH funding is harder to get, you know, and the opportunities in industry are just fantastic. I mean, there's great opportunities if you are a strong enough intellect and are, you know, able to work with integrity, that you can do some incredibly good science. I mean, all the natriuretic peptide stuff was all me. There was nothing from the sponsor, you know?
They were just a sponsor, you know, that was...
Right. But some sponsors may try to be intrusive or, you know, redirect. But, you know, if you do good science and you can make a compelling argument, that usually is a path for success. And so, you know, at BAME, previously the Harvard Clinical Research Institute, now the BAME Institute for Clinical Research, you know, I have really, really enjoyed engaging with sponsors, working with them from the very beginning. You know, there are different ways of doing clinical trials. There are some people in our community, you know, who sort of stroll onto a phase three program, like, you know, like the king or queen of England. You know, they come into a phase three, the protocol is handed to them, they just sort of go through the motions, the study's done, they get their New England Journal publication and move on. That is not what I do. You know, the way to do it is to really be a part of the machine from the very beginning, whether phase two, phase three, phase four, and really play a part in the development of the trial and really, you know, have some role other than, you know, being a figurehead, you know, when the study's executed. Some people may not like hearing me say that, but they know full well that that is how some people approach things. I do not do that. And at BAME, we're great partners for our industry, industry sponsors. We help develop protocols. We get them through the study, you know, win or lose. You know, the effort is a team effort. And it comes back to that whole point about, you know, working as a team. It also gives me a great opportunity to mentor other people who I've brought into working with us at BAME, including yourself, including Kian McCarthy, who's my junior faculty mentee, you know, people that I'm, you know, really fond of, people like Javed Butler, Akshay Desai, Ambrosh Pandey, they've joined us. Harriet Van Spall works with us, you know, and so it gives me an opportunity to work with people who I really like, people who I really want to support. At the end of it all, it also is good for patient care.
So that's fascinating. I mean, you know, I think that you've juggled all of these different balls, but you've done it in a very deliberate way. And you've also, as you mentioned, you kind of have these 5-year like windows of like, it was this era and this era. So, you know, on paper, it seems like you did all these things and, you know, I don't want someone to think that you were doing all of these things at all times, right?
No.
You compartmentalized it. It started with this and then, you know, and then shifted a little bit this. And then it's a little give and take, but you've managed to put your, you know, your toe in the puddle of, you know, leadership and CCU and training, and you've developed all these like fascinating, you know, long-term relationships. And I'm kind of like building up to the mentorship standpoint, just because I think it's, you know, you've obviously had a lot of years of doing this. You know, not trying to say anything negative.
No, it's true. I mean, you know, so first yes, 5 years,
me, yeah, for,
like first 5 years, you know, it was like 4 days a week in the office, reading echo, hardcore clinical, starting in the CCU, second 5 years, increasing the biomarker study output, starting to cut back clinically, third 5 years, no longer reading echo. So at around 10 years, I stopped reading echo. On the back end of that was when I stepped down from the CCU and took the role at HCRI. And what the last sort of, then the 5 years of the pandemic sort of was a bit of a blur, but it was largely research with some clinical, cutting back clinical more and more. Now, the next 5 years for me is really reducing my clinical volume even further while increasing the trials. I mean, you have to do this with some degree of intention, or else it's just not going to happen. And as far as mentoring is concerned, that's the one constant thing that was there from the beginning all the way to now, because, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected. And I was so fortunate to get my foot in many doors over the years. You know, mentorship and sponsorship go hand in hand. And if my foot is in the door, I want to go through the door with people. And if I can't go through that door, I'd like someone else to go through, you know, not so like if there's an opportunity that I'm not interested in, I'm not just going to say, nah, I'm not interested. I'll say I'm not interested, but I know who may be, you know, and you know, for anyone watching, I mean, like, it doesn't cost you anything to do that, you know, but it means the world for some people. And so, you know, I was saying, you know, in a group chat not long ago, I think it was a college student approached one of our colleagues and asked them for an opportunity to, I don't know, shadow or work with them or something. I say yes to that. I mean, granted, I get requests literally almost every day these days, but I say yes very frequently to this sort of request. You know, I've got a fellow coming in from another country who's going to work with me for the next 2 years. When you look at the list of mentees that I've had over the years, you know, a lot of them, and you probably didn't even realize that they were my mentees, you know, because they've gone on to really make good for themselves. And that, you know, is a source of pride for me. You know, again, in medicine, we have the opportunity to lift each other up, not just in the clinical side, but also on the academic side. And you know, I think it's something that we all should be doing. Even, by the way, at your level, at your age, at your stage, you know, you should be thinking about who you're going to be mentoring.
Well, you know, one of the themes here of this podcast, origin stories, mentorship, inflection points, you know, I think we've done a great job of covering all of that. I want to get into, you know, towards the last end here, back to the Red Sox, because I think that, you know, that's obviously such a unique opportunity. So just tell me a little bit about like how it got started and, you know, any little like fun tidbits about it. I've heard you talk about it previously on, you know, back in the clubhouse yeah. days. And I was like, oh, I didn't even realize that he's doing that. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I'll start first by saying that despite the fact that I'm 6'5", 230, 240 pounds, I look like, you know, a linebacker. I am the least athletic person you'll ever meet. I say that with no hesitation now. It used to be such a source of embarrassment. You know, I mean, sure, I could, I was a weightlifter. I could, you know, I could lift a ton, but, you know, look like a ball player, lifted weights like a ball player, not a ball player. I was just the worst, you know? So it's kind of ironic that I have 2 World Series championship rings. I've been involved with 3 championship teams. You know, I take care of generations of Red Sox players, from players, families, front office, veterans. You know, it's an incredible story, really. 2004, the Red Sox won the World Series, first time in 86 years. It's sooner or later, it's going to happen to your Buffalo Bills, by the way. And there are a number of factors that led to this. But they fired the medical staff after the season. I won't go through the details of why, but they decided to bring in the Mass General sports medicine people. Now, sports medicine at the time in 2004 was largely run by orthopedic surgery, and there wasn't a whole lot of medicine. It was really more sports surgery, really. But it was the beginning of an era when the field of sports medicine was taking off. And the orthopedic surgeon that they brought in to lead the medical staff recognized that he needed people with medical knowledge to be part of the group. And so he brought an internist, Dr. Larry Ronan, who still works with the team as I do. And Larry was my internist, my primary care doc, and he was a very faithful referrer to me. He and I had the VIP practice at, you know, Mass General. He had the VIP medicine practice. I had the VIP cardiology practice that I had inherited from Roman DeSanctis and Dolph Hutter. And so we had this very interesting relationship, and he became the internal medicine specialist. And he said, you know what? We need a cardiologist. So they brought me in. And I still have the letter inviting me. And at the time, I said, sure, what's the worst thing that could happen, right? Why would they need a cardiologist? 2 weeks later, I get a phone call that our manager was in the dugout at Yankee Stadium having chest pain. And they landed, and this is right after we won the World Series. So Tito was, Terry Francona was he was God in Boston, right? They landed a helicopter on the roof of Mass General, and I flew in a helicopter to Bedford Air Force Base, where I took a private jet to New York to get him out of New York Hospital. And that really is how it all began. And, I've been aboard now for 21 years, championships in 07, 13, and 18. I go to every spring training. My daughter works for the team now as well. And I have the fortune of knowing some really amazing players, members of the team, members of the ownership. And like I said, there's a lot of similarities between a well-functioning sports team and a well-functioning medical team.
What's your most memorable Boston Red Sox moment?
Oh, hands down, easy to tell you this one. So ALCS 2013, we had lost game one to the Tigers. Max Scherzer beat us in game one. Game two was also at Fenway. It was a 2-3-2 series. We were losing 4-0 going into the eighth inning. So we're down one game already, and now we're going into the eighth inning down 4-0. As people know, in the eighth inning, going to the bottom of the eighth, they play Sweet Caroline, right? And my wife and I were sitting in our seats. I've season tickets, right behind home plate. And we're sitting in our seats, and they start playing Sweet Caroline. And I was all torqued up. I was like, we're losing. This sucks. We're going to be down 2-0.
And it's going back.
And people are singing Sweet Caroline. I was like, I said to Roberta, my wife, I was like, let's leave. I'm like, I can't, this is ridiculous. And to her credit, she was like, no, we're sticking. So bottom of the eighth inning comes around, and the Red Sox load the bases. And up to the plate comes David Ortiz. Poppy is a patient of mine. He's a friend of mine. And I had seen him before the game, they changed their pitcher to a lefty reliever that Ortiz earlier in the season had struck out against. And earlier in the season, he struck out on a cut fastball. And Poppy talks about this even now. He said that he knew that the first pitch he was going to get from this guy was a cutter. And so he was sitting on it. And he hit this frozen rope. I didn't think it was going to get out. Our seats are right behind home plate, looking right down the first baseline. And he hit the ball straight towards the bullpen in right field. And I didn't think it had enough height to get over the fence. But the way we knew that he hit a grand slam was we saw Torrey Hunter trying to catch the ball, flipping over the fence into the bullpen. I have never, to this day, seen Fenway blow up that way, because all of a sudden we had life again, and we went on to not only beat the Tigers, but we ended up winning the World Series. We swept the Cardinals in four games in the series in 2013. So, It's just a remarkable experience.
Every time, I had a feeling you'd say that one. I never actually asked you what the most memorable one was.
Yeah.
Every time I see that clip, I text you or I send it to you and everything like that. And I actually met Torrey Hunter in the Bahamas one time.
Nice guy. Really nice guy.
Super nice guy. He was making jokes and everything like that. Like talking to everybody, not a celebrity at all, which is like awesome.
No. And it's really refreshing when you meet people like Torrey, like Ortiz. Ortiz is the same way. When he comes to see me in the office, he doesn't sneak in the back door. He sits in the waiting room. Patients go and talk to him. He loves it,
That is awesome. All right. So You know, we've talked about a ton. You know, your story is fascinating. You know, thank you so much. A couple things towards the end here. Where do you, not to get too deep, but keep this one brief. Where do you see the field of medicine going in the next couple of years? What are you excited about?
I'm really excited about the emergence of genetic and genomic therapies. You know, gene therapy has not really taken off in cardiology until now, but now with CRISPR, with gene editing and silencing of genes using small inhibitory RNAs or silencing of RNA expression, you know, I really see that as the future. So I see therapeutics really moving from small molecules, pills, to injectables that are once a month or just once period, you know, gene editing. There are vehicles being developed to deliver those therapies straight to the heart, rather than using adenovirus. There are now means to deliver to the heart that are more durable to allow for CRISPR. So I'm really excited about that, but I'm also very excited on the other end of the spectrum, all the way early, on the increasing focus on prevention. As a general cardiologist, whether we talk about, you know, lipid lowering, better blood pressure control, more durable blood pressure control, treatment of obesity that's more durable than, you know, once a week shots, as well as, of course, prevention of heart failure. To me, you know, all of those areas are now getting the appropriate focus that, you know, I think it should.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the emerging themes on this podcast, and it's so awesome to see is, you know, we had Martha Galati on and we talked a lot about prevention, and even Andrew Sauer, who's, you know, a heart failure transplant doc that's now moved into the cardiometabolic and prevention space, you know? So I even see people pivoting their own careers and everything like that.
Coming to where I've been for the last 25 right. years, pointing it's, at NT-proBNP.
All roads lead to Rome, right?
All roads lead to NT-proBNP, exactly.
I think that's actually the saying, was that Julian Caesar that said that. So the last thing that we like to ask, and we've gotten so many awesome tidbits from you, but is there anything else that, like, I don't know about you or that others maybe don't know about you that's like a cool tidbit? You know, Andrew Sauer said that he's great with like instruments and singing. So now, you know, we're going to make him do that. And as an aside, you know, I know you and I have always shared the love of music and live music and everything like that. And, you know, I remember a time at ACC in New Orleans where we tried to get you up on the stage and play guitar.
Right.
Which almost happened, but, you know, but all these things that
I waved that off. So, you know, I've already sort of dropped a few tidbits. I mean, you know, the fact most people who know me would not believe that I was a complete disaster academically in college, in part because of the music thing, which is the other tidbit. Athlete, absolutely not. Look like an athlete, not an athlete. On the other hand, I've been a musician my entire life. I've played in bands my whole life, including, you know, until about, you know, the mid 2000s. You know, 2010-ish, you know, all through the first decade of the 2000s, I was playing in a band here in Boston, all over the city. We were playing gigs every week, you know, and it just got to the point where the day job, you know, kind of got in the way. You know, I was promoted to professor in 2013. That was sort of around the time when, you know, I had to stop, you know, gigging because I couldn't. I mean, you know, I would get home from a gig on a Thursday night at like 2 a.m. and get up for work at 5:30, you know, and, you know, it just wasn't consistent with survival. So, you know, I had to cut it back, but I still play. I still, you know, will play a gig here and there with friends. But that would probably be the thing that people don't know about me.
Okay. One last question. What's your favorite place in Italy to visit or anywhere in Europe?
Well, you know, my wife is from Italy and she went to university in Paris, actually. So our favorite place in Europe is probably Paris. We go there with some frequency. I was just there 2 weeks ago after the heart failure meetings. You know, I got married in Rome. I love Rome. Tuscany probably is my favorite place in Italy, though. You know, there are places in Tuscany where I would love to just buy a farmhouse and retire. So, you know, if anyone is interested, DM me and I'll give you some places to go. There's some really remarkably beautiful places.
Well, this was a fantastic discussion. You know, thank you so much for your time, insights, you know, on a personal level, our friendship, your mentorship that you've given to me. I can, you know, say firsthand, you know, I was just some random resident at Penn State that reached out to you. And you know, you've been such a blessing in my career and in my life in general. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast, sharing your knowledge, sharing your insights. I hope that the listeners enjoy it and really learn a lot from it, because you've had such an amazing career. But it did, you know, it didn't really start out down that path, and you kind of willed it into existence, probably with that, you know, European background and chip on the shoulder and everything, all these things, you know. So it was in your genes. And so, yeah, thanks again.
Thanks so much, Alex. It's been great seeing your career taking off, and it's been great talking today. I'm looking forward to watching your career in 5-year blocks. Okay.
All right. We'll make sure to make that happen.
Right. Well,
thank you so much. All right. Until next month, which we have an exciting guest next month. We'll share that soon on social media who it'll be next, but I can't wait. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Moving the Needle in Medicine. I want to thank Jim Januzzi for sharing his insights, experiences, and perspective on the evolution of cardiovascular medicine, scientific innovation, and mentorship. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to subscribe to Moving the Needle in Medicine on HCP Live, YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. For more conversations with the clinicians, researchers, and leaders helping shape the future of medicine, visit hcplive.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.